Chapter 7. The Ardbrecon monastic settlement, when they reached it, looked to be in very poor shape. Many buildings outside the enclosure were in ruins. Little cultivation and few livestock were to be seen. The protective dike was crumbling in several places, and there was no gatekeeper at the entrance. At first they thought the whole monastery was deserted. Then a very old priest, lame and leaning on a stick, came hobbling to meet them. He was, he told them, Uchig, abbot of Ardbrecon. You are welcome here, though I fear our hospitality is not what it once was. He led the travellers to the refectory, where he listened to their account of their travels. Uchig's voice was weak, and he had to stop from time to time when a fit of coughing took him. I believe I can help you with at least some of your questions, he said. You see, when I was a young priest just ordained, I was present at the talks between Ultan and Cogitosis. Another young priest called Tirukon was there too. He left us long ago. But first I must tell you that our monastery has declined a great deal since then. 5 years ago, a dreadful plague killed most of our community. I was one of only 6 survivors. We managed to carry on somehow, but we couldn't mount an effective defence against a band of raiders who arrived soon after the plague had died down. They burnt most of our buildings, even the orphanage that our founder, St. Brecon, had set up. Luckily, it was empty at the time. We lost most of our livestock and stores and all our gold and silver altar vessels. Now we must celebrate Mass with wooden vessels. The Mass is no worse for that, of course, but we can't give fitting honour to the Lord. There are still only 15 of us, with some estate workers and their families, but we are rebuilding slowly, very slowly. The abbot broke off at this point, promising to devote all of the following day to his guests. His brother monks were trooping into the refectory for the evening meal. There would have been nothing but thin soup and porridge had Mirku not donated enough of his own supplies to allow each monk to have some extra food. Mirku was honoured by being asked to choose and read a passage from scripture during the meal. To encourage the group of harassed and undernourished men at the table, he chose the psalm beginning, "The Lord is my shepherd." In future years, this moment remained vivid in his memory, the pale, exhausted faces turned towards him, the flickering candles in the calm summer twilight, the farmyard noises and smells drifting in through the windows from where the cattle were stabled in the shell of what had once been the infirmary. He drew a deep breath and began in a firm, resonant voice, using Irish instead of the usual Latin, to make the psalm more immediate to his listeners. Sheon tirna mere, ni vegean ni diurum. That it may be so for them, Lord, his mind prayed behind the words. And in the time allowed for general conversation after the meal, it did seem that the very fact of having visitors from so far away had a cheering effect on the beleaguered congregation. Later, the abbot brought the 3 travellers to what was left of the monastery guesthouse. The roof is still intact over the western part of the building, he pointed out. There are some spare robes and blankets, rather worn, I'm afraid, that you could wrap yourself in. They were so tired by now that neither draughts, holes in the blankets, nor residual smells of burnt timber could keep them awake. Next morning they had risen, washed, and eaten some porridge in the kitchens by the time Abbot Uchig came from the chapel to meet them. Phelim had volunteered for manual work and gone to help the monks and lay tenants who were rebuilding the orphanage. "That's one of my main concerns," Uchig explained. "The orphanage was started by our holy founder, St. Brecon, and Ultan had a great regard for it too. There are still many children orphaned by war, plague, or raiding, and they need our help." Mirku and Donacha went with Uchig to the monastery library. It was large, but its shelves were mostly empty and dusty. Only a few books and loose tablets were dotted here and there. "We lost most of our books in the raiding," the abbot told them. "These are the few that we managed to rescue." This used to be a fine library in Ultan's time. He was made librarian here when he retired from his episcopal see in the north. The 2 visitors sat on a rough bench and faced the abbot across a table. A young novice waited on a stool nearby, ready to provide any service they might need. "I'm very glad you've come and that you're doing your research," said Uchig, "because I think a life of Patrick is badly needed. The times we live in certainly call for something to strengthen people's faith. Ultan was working towards it, and Cogitosis was planning something, but that was long ago, and we still haven't got a proper life. I hope to see one before I die." The abbot Mirku thought seemed much livelier today, reinvigorated by the prospect of helping with the work he wanted to be done. "Now," Uki went on, "you could start by telling me how much you know already about Patrick." "Not at all as much as we need," Mirko explained. "For a start, we've both read Patrick's Confessio carefully. So we know of his father and grandfather, the name of the place where he spent his childhood, though not where it was, his kidnapping and slavery as a herdsman in Ireland, though again not where, his escape with divine help in a ship crewed by pagans, but to what country? His rescue from starvation in answer to prayer, another brief captivity, a return to his relatives in Britain, voices calling him back to Ireland, and his journey to our island to convert the Tuatha. After that, we have a lot about his prayer practices, his devotion to the Holy Scriptures and to the Holy Spirit, his intense desire to complete his mission of bringing people to God, his defence against some allegations that were made against him, and the fact that he travelled round baptising people and using his own resources to buy safe conduct. But as I'm sure you know, Abbot Uki, there are only stray bits of information in the Confessio about the detail of his missionary time in Ireland. For instance, that some women tried to give him jewellery, and that he suffered serious attack at least once. There are hardly any place names in the whole Confessio. It just doesn't add up to enough for a proper life of Patrick. It's true that we have a few more bits of information. For instance, we have a copy of his letter condemning the tyrant kidnapper Coroticus, who killed some of Patrick's converts and enslaved others. And because we belong to the Sleaty community, we know the story of our founder Fiuk, pupil of the poet Dufuch, who, reliable tradition tells us, was the only one to rise to his feet to honour Patrick when the saint went to confront King Lara at Tara. And one other thing. In my home region of Cola, I've heard storytellers relate that a church there was founded by Mounthán Gaptooth, a disciple of Patrick, who lost some teeth to a stone thrown at him when the saint first arrived on mission. Mirko fell silent. "Well," said Uki, "what you have is a good start. Will we discuss now those notes made by Cogitosis?" "Yes, indeed," Mirko replied. "Donacha, while I rest my voice for a while, would you please tell Father Abbot about those notes?" Donacha took up the narrative. Dipping into the memory house in his mind, he repeated each of the notes to Uki. There was a short silence while Uki thought about these. Then he looked up. "Time for me to do some explaining," he began. "I told you I was at the meeting between Ulton and Cogitosis. Well, I was also at the long talks between Ulton and his assistant Tirachán. Those went on for months. I wasn't participating. I was just the junior assistant, there to make sure they had pens, tablets, inks, food, drink, anything they might call for, just like our young friend Daglan from the Dacia over there," nodding to the blushing novice in the corner. "But I was a good listener, and I have a good memory even still, so I can tell you something about each of those notes. At least, I can make them less mysterious. But first, an important fact. Ulton didn't write a life in the real sense. He was planning one, but he died before he could write it. What he did leave was some disconnected episodes in no particular order, making up what could be called a book. It contains material on other saints too, but that's another day's work. I'll give you that book to read. Daglan, fetch it, would you? And it will cover some of Cogitosis' points." Here Uki was seized by a long fit of coughing. By the time he recovered, Daglan had found Ulton's book and placed it before the abbot. Mirko had been listening with all his attention. Now he remembered he was dealing with a frail old man. "Would you prefer to rest for a while and continue our discussion later, Father Abbot?" he asked. "No, ho, not at all," Uki told him. "I'm going to enjoy setting out information for you. You see, when I was a young man, I used to track wild animals for the hunters of my tuath. I could tell you everything about a distant deer or boar, just from hoof prints or disturbed foliage. Now I'm tracking those long-ago talks about St. Patrick through the fields and woods of my memory." Uki put both hands on the book before him. "I'll give you this to read when we finish our discussion," he said. "Now, what was the first Cogitosis point?" Donacha was already in the memory house, reaching down an imaginary tablet from the first imaginary cupboard on his left. "It reads Buadach Victoricus, Ulton," Father Abbot, he announced. "Now, as you know," Uki resumed, "Patrick says in the Confessio that when he was safely back with his relatives in Britain, he saw a vision of a man called Victoricus, like one from Ireland, bringing messages begging him to return. And he tells us too that long before that, when he was a slave in Ireland, he had a revelation and heard a voice telling him he was to travel home soon and that his ship was ready about 200 miles away. Now, was it Victoricus in both cases? And was Victoricus an angel or a human? That's what Ultan and Tyrochon were arguing about. Mirko interrupted. You mean Ultan and Tyrochon had arguments? Wouldn't Tyrochon just obey? Ochig laughed. That was one of their mildest arguments, he said. You need to understand what those two holy men were like. Ultan was a devoted, elderly, hard-working scholar, but a very obstinate one. Sometimes when he got hold of an idea, he was like a dog with a bone. Tyrochon was younger by more than 40 years, and he was completely different. He was clever, ambitious, and assertive. He found obedience a very difficult virtue to practice. Tyrochon was from Connacht, from Tyrawley in the far northwest by the great ocean, and he was a great supporter of his Tuath and of all his native region, but he was also a keen supporter of Armagh expansion. He wanted Patrick's Armagh parochia to be spread as widely as possible. At the time, I thought his ambition might have had something to do with that. Armagh was already the up-and-coming power in the church, and I suppose he'd have liked to be on the winning side. I wonder, added Uchi with a twinkle in his eye, whether you might be feeling a little of that as well? Father Abbot, said Mirko, shocked, I must tell you that this task is a burden imposed on me. I certainly never sought it, inexperienced as I am in such work. On the other hand, murmured Dunica, it won't exactly damage our careers, will it? Brother Dunica, Mirko snapped, that is not the point, and your remark is entirely inappropriate. Uchi had another query. But you're Muchu Muchtena, aren't you? And isn't that territory in the Armagh region? Yes, Father Abbot, it is. My father came from there as a refugee, fleeing from a feud, and became a master fisherman in Coola, where I was born. So I have no real connection with the Muchu Muchtena. I see, said Uchi. Well, as I was saying, those two enthusiasms of Tyrochon's sometimes came into conflict with each other. Then he got less self-assured. We'll see that when we come to some of the later notes. As for the Victoricus question, Tyrochon said it must have been an angel. He seemed to feel that it would look better for Patrick's prestige. It was entirely likely, he said, that God would send an angel, even send one twice, when the conversion of Ireland was at stake. But Ultan thought Victoricus was probably a man. He argued that the Irish equivalent of Victoricus, Buadach, would be quite a probable nickname for an Irishman. And there was a record of a man called Victoricus being consecrated bishop by Patrick. Also, no angel called Victoricus was named in the Holy Scriptures. Then again, an angel could hardly be expected to give the detailed directions Patrick would need to find a particular ship 200 miles away across hostile territory. But, said Tyrochon, an angel could have escorted him all the way. After a few hours of this, they agreed that Victoricus was probably an angel in human form. Clearly God was sending messages through him, which is a well-recognised angelic function. They had a point there, said Mirko, so we'll feel free to refer to an angel. Dunica, we're putting that into the memory house now. Yes, Father Mirko, said Dunica, concentrating for a moment. Father Abbot, he went on, the second note said, four names of Patrick, Ultan. Uchi thought about this. Ah, yes, he said finally. Ultan said he had been told by two separate learned Ulúna that Patrick had four names at different stages of his life. Suchet in his boyhood, Cuthrica or Cuthirtiachus during his slavery, Magonus during his studies, and Patricius after he was consecrated bishop. You'll find all that in Ultan's book. Tyrochon didn't argue much about those names. They were both a bit puzzled about where Cuthrica could have come from. They thought perhaps it was from Cether, meaning four, because he could have worked for a group of four druids. I had doubts about that myself, but it wasn't my place to question it. We're putting the four names in our memory house, since they seem well vouched for, said Mirko. As for that group of four owners idea, I'll talk to our own abbot about that when we're back at Sleaty. He's interested in words and their origins. Donica, eyes closed, was already storing the four names and the intention to consult A in the number one, black, cupboard, second shelf down, chest high to himself, he noted. Snapping back to reality, he recited Cogitosis's third note, those ordained with Patrick, Ultan. When Cogitosis came to see us, said Uchi, Ultan told him he believed that some of Patrick's companions were ordained as priests when Patrick was consecrated bishop. At that stage, Ulton had no names for the companions. But later he talked to a foreign scholar who visited our monastery and spoke at length to Ulton about Patrick's life before his return to Ireland. He said he had seen records showing that two men named Auxilius and Isernius were ordained on the day of Patrick's consecration. Tyrconnell wasn't too pleased about this. He always preferred to have Patrick alone in his glory, but he did accept that the evidence was solid and they wrote the names in. "And so will we then," said Mirko. "Donacha, third shelf down for this." "Done, Father Mirko." The next item we have reads, "Tradition of Miracles. Ulton may list and describe." "Yes, well," said Uchi, "he did so, but some time after Cogitosa's visit. Ulton had been Bishop of Connor, you know, in the north. He had travelled a lot in the territories of the northern Inail, the patrons of Armagh, and also among the Urig and the Chrithne, as well as here in the southern Inail area of Meath and Brega. In each place, he'd talk to the local olive and analyst, poets and storytellers too, sometimes. He'd always ask about miracles, among other things. So, here at Ardbrecken, in his old age, he selected those miracles that seemed well attested and wrote them out. About a dozen of them related to Patrick, I remember. Tyrconnell had his own list. It was largely different. More Connacht items in his, for one thing. I think he had done some miracle hunting on his own account, young as he was, in this part of the country as well. But Ulton's own selection is what you'll find in this book of his. We'll read them carefully, said Mirko, and we may well use them all, subject to our own abbot's approval. I'm getting hoarse, said Uchi, rising with some difficulty and hobbling round the room. And rather stiff, too. Daghlan, see if you can get Brother Cook to let you have apples and milk for four, with a little bread. Certainly, Father Abbot, Daghlan responded in his barely broken voice and sped off towards the kitchens. Mirko and Donacha rose and stretched. The three men walked out into warm sunshine. Birds were singing in the trees that grew here and there in the enclosure and outside. I'm surprised you haven't needed to cut down those trees for fuel or building materials, Mirko remarked. We had to cut down all the others, Uchi told him, but these ones are special. Each one is named for a person buried here to whom we want to give special honour, abbots or benefactors, for instance. That big oak over there, that's Brecon. Daghlan returned, carrying a large basket. He set out wooden beakers, apples and chunks of fresh bread on the library table, filling the beakers with milk from a jug. You may sit down and eat with us, Daghlan, said Abbot Uchi. But what are you looking so excited about? Oh, Father Abbot, the boy burbled. Phelim of Sleaty went out and caught two big salmon that he wants us all to have for dinner, and he trapped a hare too. And Brother Cook begs you to approve the salmon and give us a dispensation to eat meat in the form of hare soup. And Father Prior would like Phelim to stay with us always, but I don't think he will. Mirko grinned. We need Phelim, he said. He's our driver and bodyguard. But he can come back some day if he likes. He's not a slave. And Father Abbot, it would be a great favour to your guests if you approved the menu. I won't refuse your request then, said Uchi. Daghlan, tell Brother Cook that I grant the dispensation, but that after today we're back to normal practice, meat only on Sundays and feast days. And he can serve the salmon too. The boy rushed off. When Uchi and his guests had finished their meal, the abbot thoughtfully waited until Daghlan had returned and eaten before resuming. Question of snakes, Ulton. That was the next note, wasn't it? He said. That was a bad business. It brought the final break-up a good deal closer. Break-up? Queried Mirko. What break-up was that? The break-up when Tyrconnell left us. You'll hear more about that later, Uchi explained. Now about the snakes. Ulton said he had met a gifted storyteller in Brega, over to the east of here near Inverculpa. A man who could persuade you of anything, it seems. Anyway, this golden-tongued Shkeli convinced Ulton that Patrick performed an extraordinary miracle, that he cleared the whole island of snakes. It had to be true, according to the Shkeli, because there are now no snakes in Ireland, though there are plenty in the lands of the Saxons and the Franks. Ulton admitted that a learned olive from the same area had denied this yarn, but it seems this olive had a bad stutter. People used to call him Scownlan Stadre, stuttering Scownlan behind his back, and so he didn't make a good impression. Anyway, this Scanlon quoted his three times great-grandfather, passing down the information that he, the ancestor, had attended an open-air sermon of Patrick's. Patrick said that baptism could drive evil from people's souls, just as God drove the snake from the Garden of Eden. Then someone who had seen snakes in other countries shouted from the back of the crowd, "If we had snakes here, could you drive them out?" And the holy man replied, If God decided to act through me in that way, I certainly could. So the word spread that Patrick could drive away those strange and dangerous creatures. Then some people said, "But what's the use of that? There aren't any snakes here." And some supporter of Patrick, who didn't like being contradicted, replied crossly, "Well, how do you know he hasn't driven them out already?" Yet another bystander misheard this and exclaimed, "Untus nanuntus, wonder of wonders, he's driven out the snakes already." And that was the word that got around. The Scaly said that account was all rubbish, that the stuttering Olive was just trying to discredit him out of jealousy and Patrick with him. That Scaly was so convincing that Ulton ended up believing him. This, I can tell you, and I thought it at the time, was most unlike Ulton, who was normally a hard-working, down-to-earth scholar, but anyone can have a sentimental moment, I suppose. Anyway, Tyrachon was really shocked when he heard all this. Clearly the Olive was right, stuttering or not, he declared. There must never have been snakes in our island, or else we'd have heard about them in our tales of heroes and in druidic rituals. You'll have to leave it out. But Ulton dug his heels in, saying that if Tyrachon could have heard that accomplished and learned Scaly, he'd have believed him too. Well, Tyrachon got really angry and rushed out of the library. He was back after a few minutes with the abbot of the time in tow. That abbot was rather a short-tempered, difficult man, but Tyrachon was a favourite of his. "What's this I hear, Ulton?" the abbot was shouting. "You're going to associate St. Patrick with some snake hunt? It's the greatest nonsense I've ever come across." "But Father Abbot," said poor Ulton, "it's a fact that there aren't any snakes in Ireland." "There aren't any lions either," shouted the furious abbot. "I suppose he drove them out as well, did he?" Tyrachon was standing behind the abbot, looking smug, and I was devoutly wishing to be somewhere else. "Bishop you may be," the abbot continued, "but you're not going to make a laughing stock of us all with your serpentine raw mesh, not in my monastery or not," and he stamped out. Ulton had to give in, of course. He depended almost completely on Ard Brecken for his upkeep. You won't find any snakes in his book. The whole incident certainly didn't endear Tyrachon to him, but basically Ulton was a sensible, fair-minded scholar. Only a couple of days later he told me he'd been thinking it over and now believed that Tyrachon had probably been right about the snakes. "Well, Father Abbot," said Mirko, "we're now putting a tablet inscribed No Snakes on the bottom shelf of our number one black memory cupboard, and perhaps we could move on to the next note, the one reading, Landed where, Coola?" "That's the first one that doesn't mention Ulton," Uchi remarked, "and there's a reason for that. When Cogitosis was here, he asked that question, and Ulton had no definite answer to give. The most likely places for Patrick to land when he came on his mission were Invernea in Coola or Inverculpa at the mouth of the Boyne in Brega. But of course there were other possible landing places too, further south in the Íocinsilic territory, or even up north in Muirhivne and beyond. Ulton thought it might be Invernea, but Tyrachon, always the Enail partisan, favoured Inverculpa. Neither could quote any evidence, and Cogitosis went away no wiser on this point than when he came. He must have had some thought of investigating it further himself. So we're no wiser either, Mirko concluded, and we too will have to inquire further. Dunica, we're opening up the number two red cupboard now. Those possible landing places go on the top shelf with a note for further investigation. Let's continue then, said Uchi. Your next note was Patrick's owner, Ulli, I believe. Well, if it doesn't confuse your memory house too much, I'd sooner deal with that later, together with Visit to Fochlut, because those two tricky matters are connected. For now, that would bring us to question of deer, mead. We can cope with that rearrangement, Mirko told him. Donica, would you put a note on the Patrick's owner shelf, second shelf down in the number two red cupboard, saying, see later compendium. Thank you. Now, Father Abbot, you were about to speak of this question of deer? I was, Mirko, but only to tell you I know nothing about it. All I can do is guess, and my guess is based on the fact that mead is mentioned in Cogitosis's deer note. As far as I can recall, I didn't hear Ulton say anything about deer to Cogitosis, but the two of them did spend a short time on their own, walking up and down in the open air. If deer were mentioned then, it might have been something that Ulton heard from the Olive Scownlan, who was, I think, Ulton's main source in Mead. Around then, Ulton's memory was starting to fade. If there was something about deer, he could easily have forgotten it afterwards. He seems to have forgotten other things Scownlan told him. Or he might just have been tired of arguing with Tyrachon. Tyrachon was very hostile to any idea of mixing up animals and humans. He had refused to accept a tradition, rather a doubtful one actually, that the tyrant king Coroticus had been turned into a fox to punish him for his sins. Tyrocon said that sort of thing smelled of druidic totem beliefs. Either way, you'll find nothing about deer in Ultron's book. Mirku sighed. That'll be another note for future inquiries then, he told Annika. That brings us to the second cupboard, the red one. Fourth shelf from the top, said Annika wearily. Reasons why Palladius failed. Ochi leant back. Mirku, have you ever heard of Palladius, he asked. Well, there's a story in Kula that a bishop called Palladius came over from Britain, but didn't stay long. That's all I know about him, if he existed at all. He existed all right, the abbot said. That foreign scholar who visited us knew about him. He said Pope Celestine had sent Palladius as their first bishop to the Irish who believe in Christ. But Father Abbot, Donegh exclaimed, that would mean he was here before Patrick, and that there were Christians in Ireland before Patrick. Surely that can't be right. I know it's upsetting, Brother Donegh, but that foreign scholar was very reliable and honest, and he had no reason to deceive us. I believe what he told us. It's up to Father Mirku whether he writes it up that way or not. An unexpected voice spoke up from the corner behind Mirku. They all looked at Daglan in surprise. May I speak, Father Abbot? He was saying nervously. Yes, yes, my son, you may. The saint I'm named after, from the Dacia like me, and everyone in my Tuath, believes he lived before St. Patrick's time. I believe that too, said Uchi. Patrick can't have been the first British Christian enslaved here. There were Roman traders as well. Some say they had a trading settlement by the River Nore, not too far from your monastery, Mirko, and they had coastal trade depots too. So let's say there were some Christians here before Patrick, but probably not many. Palladius was sent to them, but I'm sure he'd have liked to make converts as well. Yet our visiting scholar told us that Palladius had arrived back in Britain within a year and died there. And it's clear that he left all or most of the work of conversion to his saintly successor, Patrick. As to why exactly Palladius returned so soon, discouragement, illness, or hostility? Well, who knows? Tyrocon spoke of a tradition that Palladius was killed by the Irish, but that seemed to contradict the foreign version that Ultan had accepted. Another point for further inquiry, said Mirku. Then we'll have to think how to treat this delicate matter without reducing Patrick's standing. We'll speak to Abbot A about that. After that, Mirku continued, came the reference, where is Banavam Tabernier? You'll recall, said Uchi, that in the Confessio, Patrick gives us that name for his birthplace. Cogitosus asked Ultan where it was. Ultan didn't know. He had never heard or read any other reference to the place. He thought it must be in Britain or Gaul. Anyone could have guessed that much. But more likely Britain, because Patrick mentions relatives in that country. Further investigation there too, said Mirko. Father Abbot, I don't know about you, but I'm feeling rather tired and the afternoon is wearing on. Do you think we might adjourn until tomorrow? I certainly do, Mirku, replied Uchi gratefully. In fact, it might be best if you spent tomorrow reading Ulton's book and thinking about everything we've said today. Very good, then. We'll continue the day after tomorrow, but we'll have to leave the day after that, or else the Sleety community will be sending out search parties. Daglan came and helped the abbot to his feet, passing him his stick, and they all walked out into the enclosure. Five or six men were still working on the orphanage building, and it was clear that substantial progress had been made since morning. Mirku, that phylum of yours seems to be a very effective worker, Uchi remarked. He's one of those men who can turn their hands to anything, learns fast, and concentrates on whatever he's doing. He was still speaking when they were interrupted by a clamour out on the estate. A young monk was running towards them, waving a staff. Machtire, Machtire, he was shouting. Wolf, wolf. Phylum was the first to react. Leaving the building site, he ran to the ox cart and grabbed his throwing spears. Then he seized the fleeing monk by the shoulder and turned him round. Lead me to him, he growled. Recovering from their surprise, Mirku and Donica took their swords from under the sacks in the ox cart and followed Phylum at their best pace. 3 fields away, they found a large wolf trying to corner a lamb, having killed 2 others. They were just in time to see Phylum's spear cast pierce the animal's throat. Then he strolled over, extracted his spear, and administered the final thrust. An old warrior has a right to a quick death, he remarked. Brother, you can stop hitting him with your staff now, he's dead. Those swords won't be needed either, he added, looking at the weapons Mirku and Donica were wielding clumsily. Mind you don't cut yourselves. Mirku hadn't run so fast for years, but he gasped, trying to catch his breath. Are there more wolves? A pack? And where did he come from? I thought this area was all cleared. The shepherd monk pointed to the northeast. "Over there, beyond the river," he said, "you soon reach thick forest. We knew there were wolves there, but this is the first one to swim across." "He was old and lame and probably couldn't catch deer," Phelim remarked. "He'd have been a loner." Then he slung the dead wolf over his shoulders. They walked back to the enclosure, where several monks thanked Phelim and began to skin the carcass. "That'll make a grand cloak for you, Phelim," they said. "Give the skin to your abbot," Phelim told them. "I'd say he feels the cold more than I do." Back in their drafty lodging, Dunica expressed some doubts about the memory house. "Father Mirko, I'm afraid of forgetting some of the items we've stored. There's so much and there's more to come." "I may have a problem with it myself, Dunica. I think you'd better make notes. It's a case of special necessity, so you can use a couple of those vellum sheets we got in Kildare. But that's valuable stuff, so keep your writing small." Dinner in the refectory that evening had an almost festive air, though it was neither a feast day nor a Sunday. Not only was Phelim invited to join them, he was seated next to the prior in a place of honour. Low murmurs of appreciation could be heard through the scripture readings as the community tucked into their unaccustomed hare soup and salmon. During the permitted conversation time afterwards, Abbot Uchi invited Phelim to come and live in Ard Brecon as a monk or a layman. Whenever the Sleety community felt they could manage without him, he would be given land of his own in return for services to the monastery. "I'm grateful for the offer, Father Abbot," said Phelim, "and I'd hope to take it up within the next few years. But I'd come as a layman, and I might want to build a house and start a family here." "You'll be welcome to do so, my son. There are several empty houses on the estate just needing repairs."